Hi, my name is J.P. Baird. I am an associate professor in the Department of Psychology and the program in neuroscience. And today we're going to be interviewing David Kessler, class of 73. He's written a book titled The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. The book covers a wide range of topics going through the academic literature, which I'm very familiar with and interested in, and also explores how the food industry prepares foods. And then at the towards the end of the book, you discuss some strategies for ways about thinking about dealing with the sort of the changes in our food environment and potential issues that need to be addressed in the environment. Could you maybe just talk briefly about what motivated you to write the book?
There really were two beginnings for the books. You know, books are rarely linear. The first question that I asked was, I was in my office when I was at Yale as dean of the medical school, and I was with a group of residents and fellows, and we were sitting around the table. We were asking the question of, if you wanted to stay alive, what are the things you can do to affect your health? Three quarters of people are going to die from either cardiovascular disease, stroke, or cancer. And we were looking at what the evidence was for what was preventable. And I noted that as I was collecting all the literature, I noted that the librarian who was helping me pull all the articles at Yale lost 30 pounds. Because so much of what is preventable goes back, has its roots in excess weight. We all know that weight isn't good for us, but the extent to which it contributes to morbidity and mortality, I don't think most of us understand. But then the question became, what do you do about weight? Why is it so hard? If it was as simple as diet and exercise, calories in, calories out, everybody would do it.
Right.
So the question was what to do. And I was watching Oprah one night, and there was a woman on the show that I remember, well-educated, well-spoken, who said, I eat when my husband leaves for work in the morning. I eat before he comes home at night. I eat when I'm happy. I eat when I'm sad. I eat when I'm hungry. I eat when I'm not hungry. And then said, I don't like myself. And I was listening and trying to listen as a clinician, as a physician, and asked myself, what was I hearing? Why was this woman doing what she didn't want to be doing, but doing it anyway? And I could relate, because I have suits in every size, and I wanted to understand that behavior. So I don't think, as clinicians, really have spent enough time trying to understand what drives somebody, in this case, overeating, to be doing it despite the fact that she didn't want to be doing it.
Right, and that's a very important point. I mean, classically, you know, the argument would have been you're obese because you have a weakness of will, or you don't have the resolve to stop eating or lose the weight. But clearly, it's much more complex than that. I remember a colleague once told me. He said, you can have a terrible day at work. You can come home. You can have a fight with your significant other, your dog could run away from home, but Ben and Jerry will always be there for you. So certainly food is one way for helping people to cope with other problems in their lives.
What does that mean to be, to help cope with other problems
right.
in our lives, and how does that happen?
Right.
What is it about food that, where one uses it to cope, especially if one doesn't want to be eating? Is it simply a question of self-medication, that you're eating to stimulate certain reward centers in your brain. I didn't fully understand it. And what is it to say, you know, I, when I'm, you know, confronted with this food, you know, is this behavior that I don't want to be engaging in? Or is this behavior that I do want to be engaging in, but I know I shouldn't be engaging in? And what's the ambivalence toward this behavior? And, you know, how does the person really react to these stimuli, and how do these stimuli, you know, exert control? I mean, is it that chocolate chip cookie that has power over me, or is it the representation of that chocolate chip cookie in my brain that has power over me?
Right, and you discussed some of the literature that sort of describes how foods can tap into sort of unconscious brain processes. Maybe you would sort of could talk to us just a little bit about your findings there.
You know, the question, you use the word unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know, a term, you know, that coined you know, decades ago. But what do we even mean by that word unconscious? And what's the neurobiological correlate of that? Let me take you through the science that we did in order to try to answer the question. Let me give you the different pieces, and then we can put the pieces of the puzzle together. The first question was, what drives consumption? So with my colleagues at the University of Washington, we published a paper recently, not the typical title of a scientific paper, called Deconstructing the Vanilla Milkshake. And we wanted to know whether it was sugar, whether it was the fat, or was the flavor as the main driver of consumption. So we did experiments with laboratory animals to see how hard they would work for those substances and combinations of those substances. So very simple, very traditional types of behavioral testing. You know, how hard would a laboratory animal, how many times would a laboratory animal press a lever? You'd press the lever once, you'd get the food, then you'd have to press it twice and get the food, then four times and get the food, then eight times you'd have to before you get the food, and then it multiples. So sometimes you'd have to press 64 times before you would get the food. So it was an indicator of how hard the animal would work for food, and there are laboratory paradigms where you can do this with humans, but it gives you an extent of how hard somebody is willing to work for the food, or an extent of, you know, what their quote drive would be, if we could use that word. So what do you think it was? Do you think it was the sugar? Do you think it was the fat? Do you think it was the flavor?
I would think it was the combination. Certainly the fat is not sweet. I would say it was the sugar combined with the fat and the flavor, the mixture.
You'll understand this, you know, as a scientist, as a psychologist, that, you know, sugar was the main driver on what scientists call the variable ratio test. The threshold, you know, animals work hardest for sugar over fat or flavor. But when you added the fat, certainly on what's, you know, those tests that are called fixed ratio tests, it was synergistic. The animals would work hard for fat and sugar over sugar alone. Flavor, interestingly, didn't drive the work of the animal. Sugar was the main driver, but when you add it together, you saw that it was synergistic. Let me give you the second set of experiments we did. They were with my colleague Gaetano Dicieri, one of the great pharmacologists, neuropharmacologists in Italy. Gaetano has traditionally studied dopamine levels and dopamine neurocircuitry after administration of certain drugs like amphetamine and cocaine. And, you know, he would administer those drugs and see elevations in brain dopamine circuits. And it, now that we know the dopamine doesn't, you know, it doesn't result in pleasure, but it really locks in your attention. It focuses you. It gates, you know, what stimuli you end up focusing on. And with amphetamine and cocaine, you see elevated levels of dopamine after administration. And on repeat administration, you see that dopamine levels continue to rise. You don't get habituation. Food, on the other hand, was always believed to give you a little bump in dopamine the first time you would give a food. But second, third time, you would get habituation. You would not get the same rise. So food was just not as powerful a stimulant as amphetamine and cocaine and other illegal drugs. And what I asked Gitano to do, what we did, was let's make food multisensory now. Let's take fat and sugar, not just sugar alone, and see whether that altered the dopamine levels. And in fact, when you do that, when you make food more palatable, more multisensory, more potent, if you want, you see that you have increases in dopamine levels. And not only increases in dopamine levels, but you see that the dopamine levels on the second and third times of administration do not decrease.
Yes, and I noticed you'll be presenting some data with one of my personal professional acquaintances, András Hangyal, at the 2009 Society for Ingestive Behavior conference. Could you briefly comment on those findings
really,
as well?
It's the same basic paradigm, and we're studying, you know, the effect of food on dopamine. And the fact is that when you make food more multisensory, it has effects on the neural circuitry. And you know, when you add fat, sugar together, it has a more profound effect.
Right.
Third piece of science.
Sure.
I wanted to understand how many people were like, you know, that woman on Oprah. What was it that we were seeing with that woman? What was this, you know, eating when she was not hungry, eating when she was happy, eating when she was sad? You know, we've used terms like emotional eating. We've used terms like compulsive eating. You know, this wasn't an eating disorder. She didn't qualify for any of the criteria, you know, of any additional psychopathology. She didn't eat huge amounts. You know, she didn't go through gallons of ice cream at any one sitting. So it wasn't the traditional definitions of an eating disorder. What I wanted to understand was how many people had similar kind of experiences as this woman. So it's self-report. But we looked at three basic criteria. First, we asked the question, you know, hard time resisting your favorite foods. You know, a loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods. Second, a lack of satiation, a lack of feeling full when you're eating, a hard time stopping. Three, a preoccupation, a thinking about food between meals, or even when you're eating something, you're thinking about what you're going to be eating next. So three characteristics: loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods, lack of satiation, a preoccupation, thinking about foods between meals. Those three characteristics. We want to know what percent of people, you know, had those three characteristics. And what we did was based on certain databases, we looked at those characteristics and found that 50% of people who were obese, 30% of people who were overweight, 20% of people who were healthy weight, not just people who were obese, not just overweight. But there are people who are healthy weight that self-reported these characteristics too. I mean, scored very high on all three characteristics. Now, that may not seem like a lot of people, 50% of obese, 30% of overweight, 20% of healthy weight. But if you extrapolate, and there's, you know, risks of extrapolation, I mean, that's from 70 million people self-report those characteristics. And there are certainly, you know, many of us who score some of those characteristics, just not as extreme as others. Millions of people have this loss of control, lack of satiation, a preoccupation with food. Those three characteristics are, at least in, you know, in my sense, are evidence of a conditioned and driven behavior. Now let me just give you the last part of the science.
Sure.
With my colleague Dana Small at Yale, we did the neuroimaging of these people who have what we call conditioned hypereating, this loss of control, lack of satiation, preoccupation with thinking about foods. This phenotype, you know, this sort of syndrome, it's not a disease, but this constellation of characteristics. And we scanned them. We did the fMRI, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, so we can look in their brains. We did it in two phases. First was just the anticipation of food. It didn't give them the food, but we just cued them. You know, a cue can be sight, smell, location, time of day. Mm-hmm. Just your car can be a cue, because based on where you've gone before, you get in the car and you have certain thoughts of wanting. When I landed at San Francisco Airport, every time I land, I start thinking about Chinese dumplings. Why? Because in the food court, you know, at the airport, based on prior learning, prior experience, there was this food court where they had these Chinese dumplings. So every time the plane lands, you know, I get cued and I start thinking about these Chinese dumplings. So we cue these individuals. We just give them the smell. And what we saw in people who had this phenotype, this syndrome, this condition of hypereating, we saw excess activation of the amygdala. And what was interesting was when we gave them the food to taste, there continued to be the excess activation of the amygdala, which is part of the brain's reward circuitry. And the activation remained so until all the food was gone. So we now have a biological neural correlate of this behavior, of why it's so hard to resist. It's not because of a lack of willpower. It's because we can now demonstrate there's excessive activation of the brain's reward circuitry.
But you also note in the book that, you know, something seemed to change around the 1980s when you look at body mass index. I think recently it was just announced that 30% of the country is now obese, or adults in the country. So something changed. And I guess my question is, you know, the human psyche hasn't changed that much over millennia or hundreds of years. So I would guess that we had people who were susceptible to these symptoms of conditioned hypereating. What do you think is sort of exacerbated the problem to produce more obesity?
Certain individuals who had the opportunity to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, again, we don't have the psychology. We didn't have the fMRIs to ask them. I mean, go back, or who was it? It was Henry VIII, right? I mean, he had an environment where he had foods that were rich in fat, sugar, and salt. We didn't get a chance to ask him whether he had loss of control, lack of satiation, preoccupation with food. But his environment clearly was different. And certainly beginning in the 1980s, around then, our environment began to change pretty dramatically. The business plan of the modern American food company was beginning several decades ago to take fat, sugar, and salt, put it on every corner, make it available 24/7, make it socially acceptable to eat anytime. But back certainly when I was growing up, even when I was at Amherst, I mean in the early 1970s, you know, we tended to eat during meals. There was structure to our eating. Today, we've taken down that structure. You know, you could eat in a lecture hall, you could eat at a meeting, you could go walk down the street, you can eat in your car, there's food you buy in your gas station. I mean, look at the French, for example. French always ate highly palatable food, but they ate during structure. They ate with structure. They would never find it socially acceptable to eat between meals. It's also true of the Canadians. So we've always had stimulation. You know, my grandmother, you know, clearly cooked with fat, sugar, and salt, and we occasionally, you know, had, you know, we had desserts that were rich in fat and sugar, but we didn't have them constantly.
Right.
So what we've done, I think, is very much changed our environment, and today we get constantly bombarded. You know, you walk down the street, you get bombarded with food cues, and it's acceptable to eat anytime. We know when you look at smokers, if you say to a smoker, it's impossible for you to smoke for the next 4 hours. Nothing you do is going to get you that cigarette.
Right.
And you then cue them, and you scan their brains. You see that there's not activation. Only when you believe you can have access to the cigarette and it's possible do you get activated and develop the real desire. So you watch a smoker on a plane. If they know they can't smoke for 4 or 5 hours, I mean, I haven't yet seen a smoker open the emergency exit and say, I need a cigarette. It's at the end of the flight when they know they can have access.
Right.
Where the thoughts of wanting start to increase. It's also, if you study people who, for religious reasons, fast, when do they start developing the desire? When do they start developing, when does their brain get activated? And it's when food becomes possible.
That's a very good point. I remember reading a quote from another book of a patient who's an individual who's undertaking a diet, and they were lamenting how difficult it was to resist the foods. And they said, you know, if you told me tomorrow that peanuts were no longer kosher, I would be able to resist them without a problem. It would be very simple, but I can't do that with all these other foods. Yet we do have people who are, say, moral vegetarians, and certainly have, you know, religious type approaches to the foods that they choose to eat. Do you see the sort of cognitive strategies that you discuss later in the book sort of helping people to achieve sort of a religious type approach to avoiding certain foods, if that makes sense?
Sure. First, you know, it's interesting you use a religious type of approach. You mean certain dietary restrictions?
Yeah, dietary restriction for moral reasons, yeah.
You know, there are implications for, you know, why does AA work? Why does Overeaters Anonymous work? And why do social norms work? And what I didn't fully understand is how social norms can affect not only our individual behavior, but it can affect, you know, literally how my brain gets activated. I mean, in the end, I mean, if you take a reinforcing substance, I mean, take cigarettes, right? I mean, look over the last 3-4 decades. How did we succeed? I mean, the success we've had to date with cigarettes. Right? Cigarettes, tobacco has always been a reinforcing substance. Haven't changed the product. You know, the laws have pretty much have not changed. Certainly, the regulation of the product. Only the president signed it several weeks ago. Finally, but what was the real success? What was the real change? I mean, back 30, 40 years ago, people looked at that cigarette and said, that's my friend, that's going to be cool, that's going to be sexy, I want that. It was, you know, scientists call it, it was positively valenced. Mm-hmm. Right? So you looked at it, you perceived it, that stimulus is something you wanted. Today, we look at a cigarette and say, what? We say, that's a deadly, disgusting, addictive product. I don't want that. So you change it from friend to enemy. So when you deal with a stimulus, if you view that stimulus as something you want, what are you going to do? You're going to approach it. If you view it as something you don't want, what are you going to do? You're going to avoid it. So in some ways, if you're a vegetarian, you look at animal fats and animal proteins and say, "What? I don't want that." So then you don't get cued. You don't get activated. So in some ways, what our social norms are, how I perceive the stimulus, affects whether I'm going to, my brain's going to be activated or not activated. If you look at AA, why does AA work? Or at least, our data is not great, the studies, but it probably is as effective as any treatment for a reinforcing substance. In some ways, it establishes very prescribed rules, and rules are important. If you believe in the rule, if you have ambivalence toward the rule, that inner dialogue, boy, that looks good, now I shouldn't have it, yes, I want that, no, not now. I mean, that only increases the reward value of the stimulus. But if you really have a rule, no, I'm not going to do that, right? That's not my friend. And, in the case of AA, they give it a moral imperative, spiritual imperative, that only adds to the person viewing alcohol as not their friend, as negatively valenced. So it makes it easier to resist. Right. I think that's the way it works.
Right. And I love the way you started the book with the personal example, relating to sort of an interesting loophole or weakness of human psychology, in a sense, called the white bear problem, in describing how efforts at suppressing a thought actually make the problem worse for an individual.
So now let's go through it. But why is it so hard? Why is maintaining weight in the current environment so hard? Because most, diets don't work. They can work in the short run. Right? If you're wired a certain way, your brain is sensitive and responds to certain cues. Certainly for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, you can lose, weight. And you keep it off for a while. But if you continue to have that old neural circuitry, that old learning, you go back into your environment, you get bombarded with the same cues. You've not laid down new learning. What do you think's going to happen? Of course you're going to get bombarded with those cues again, and you're going to gain back the weight. So the real question is, now that we know that the brain is being activated, and there's this cycle of consumption, what do I mean by that? You have excess, based on past learning, past memories, you get cued, the sight, the smell, that cue activates the brain, it causes arousal, it locks in attention, you consume the food, there's that momentary sense of pleasure, it occupies working memory, for the moments you're eating, so you're almost in a distracted state, you have that pleasure. But then the next time you get cued, you do it again, and you're constantly in this activation, arousal, release, state, and there's no real satisfaction. Right? And sure, there's a momentary sense of pleasure, but you're always in this cycle, and you end up doing this behavior only to strengthen the neural circuitry to do it again. So you're always chasing the next reward. But the question that I find fascinating, and really the most important one, is how can you navigate your own brain neural circuitry? Because once the circuitry is laid down, when you're cued, your brain gets activated. Right? That's in essence, we don't have a great word for it, right? But you're doing that for what? You're doing that for stimulation. You're doing that for stimulation and release. You're doing that, both. You can be doing it sometimes to stimulate yourself. You can do it sometimes to calm yourself down. Right? I mean, why do we eat when we're anxious? Why do we eat when we're happy or when we're sad? Is that mood state just a cue? because, you know, in the past, you know, I've been anxious, or I've been happy, or I've been sad and I've eaten, so I feel that way, and that arousal release, you know, cycle that I go through, you know, it, well, that calms me down, and that mood is actually just a cue. Or do I do it to self-medicate? But once I say, you know, or I start engaging in that behavior, and I say, no, I want to stop that behavior, then, you know, if I still, you know, there's still a part of me that wants that, you know, to calm down, or that stimulation, or that momentary distraction, you know, does that increase the reward value? And does the behavior shift, not just being impulsive, does it become compulsive? And do I now, you know, need that release or that stimulation in order to feel better? And is that why I get locked in? You know, so why is it so hard to stop this behavior once we have this cycle? Once my brain is activated, once I have the amygdala, the reward circuitry is activated, why can't I interfere with that?
Yeah, it's certainly a significant challenge. And can you maybe just sort of discuss some ways to begin to engage sort of cognitive strategies, behavioral strategies that you suggest in the book that would help people to begin to sort of address that?
It's interesting. You use the word, you know, first cognitive, then you use behavioral. You know, obviously, the you know, that's based on the assumption, cognitively, that, you know, the way I think, the way I think about a stimulus, I can control. Right, I can control my thoughts, and I can control my behavior. So it's very interesting to me. Is this part cognitive? You know, I mean, can I simply change the drive, this brain activation, by thinking differently? You know, the whole field of cognitive behavioral psychology. Can I change this neural circuitry by acting differently? I mean, can I change this neural circuitry by having different emotions? You know, it's interesting how, you know, psychology has advanced over the last several decades. But which is it, and why does it work? I mean, once you understand that your brain is being activated, and being bombarded with these cues, and that's what's triggering you to eat. Right? What are the things that are obvious? First, you can get rid of the cues. So, you know, I in my house, I get rid of the fat, sugar, and salt, and I try to make my environment a safer place, so I'm not getting, certainly the sight, the easy access to those cues. But, you know, how realistic is that? I walk down the street, I get in my car, my environment is such that outside of my house I constantly get cued. So it's not a very realistic strategy these days. Second, the best way, in the way that it used to work, was to restrict the number of times, to develop, in essence, private rules for ourselves that were going to guide our behavior. And if I had rules that I was going to live by and wanted to follow, then maybe that would help, you know, decrease the activation of the brain in this constant bombardment. You know, one of the ways that we've talked about is to eat in a planned and structured way. Now, why does that work? Because if I know what I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat it, and that's what I want to eat, then maybe I'm not constantly having my brain activated, you know, in between when I'm eating. So eating in a planned, structured, non-chaotic, non-disorganized way certainly helps. We know that people who study weight loss find structure to be one of the most important determinants of ability to lose weight. But even that, people become bored with after a while. Probably the best way to change is to change your appraisal of the stimulus. And, you know, what psychologists call, Arthur Ludwig called it, a critical perceptual shift. I mean, how you view the stimulus Is that viewed as my friend? Is that viewed as my enemy? Is that viewed as something I want? Is that viewed as something I don't want? So what are the different approaches to that? You know, certain people become vegetarians. Again, that's easy because then their brains, you know, are not being activated when they get bombarded with all these animal fats and animal proteins. They say, I don't want that. Certain people say, I just want to eat organic food. They want to eat whole foods. They don't want to eat all processed foods. So their brain is not being activated. I now get to the point where I look at big portions, you know, big food, and say, you know, I don't want that. That to me looks disgusting. So how we appraise food, how we look at food, what our relationship with food, what do we really want from food? Yes, it tastes good, but is that what I want? That's a probably the best way is to change your appraisal of the stimulus.
And at the end of the book, you talk a little bit about what we could do to begin to change social norms, much in the same way we've seen the norms change for cigarettes.
Once you realize that our brains are being activated, that our behavior is becoming conditioned and driven, I mean, there are, you know, it's not just us that our behavior is becoming conditioned and driven, it's the behavior of our children are becoming conditioned and driven. So we're laying down that neural circuitry for a lifetime. Does that have implications for the food industry? Absolutely. I mean, the food industry has to change. Does that mean government should have a greater role in education? In disclosure, there are implications for our school lunch programs, where we have vending machines, what we use our tax subsidies and what crops to subsidize. Absolutely. But in the end, just because our brains are being constantly bombarded with these cues doesn't mean we can't take control, you know, ourselves and try to prevent our brains from constantly being hijacked and being manipulated.
Well, I'm encouraged by the fact that, you know, if this has emerged so recently and we've seen success with smoking, certainly we should be able to achieve success in this domain as well. Would you care to share any of your feelings about your ambitions for seeing changes in the near future?
You know, you use the word near future. I mean, tobacco took us, what, 50 years? We created imagery of the product. And it took us 50 years to reverse that. And tobacco, we can live without.
That's a good point. You can't live without food. Well, are there any other points that maybe I didn't address that perhaps you would want to share with us?
It's terrific. We go on for hours.
We could.
I really appreciate this very much. I mean, what to me is, you know, fascinating, you know, is I thought when I began this journey to understand why it was so hard for this woman to resist eating. In my own case, I thought I would enter, you know, the world of physiology and bariatrics and nutrition.
Right.
But I really ended up trying to understand what makes us human, and found myself, what's the neuroscience? What's the psychology? You know, how do our minds work? That to me is key.
Well put, and. I would like to thank you for your time, and I hope everybody gets a chance to read the book. It's very accessible. Does a great job of covering, like I said, academia, food industry, and you know, legislation and social norms and all of those issues we discussed. And I'd like to say.